I was playing when you walked in was an early rock and roll band by the name of the Fugs, F-U-G-S. That was from about 1953. The point being that, like the Fluxus movement at that time, popular music had switched from being implicitly protesting society, like the folk song movement of the late 50s and early 60s, to explicitly confronting society. I had to turn it off there because it starts getting extremely obscene. It's not the kind of music you could ever play on the radio. The cuts all blend together, so there's like no little three-minute segment. It's just one thing after another sort of merging into all sorts of different textures. So popular music, like Fluxus, was sort of really pushing the limits of definition again. What is that? Does that really sound like rock and roll? Obviously, it'd be very difficult to dance to. It's not the kind of music that one associates with, certainly, rock and roll that's coming out of the 70s. And as I said before, because of this lack of definition in a certain way, the categories between popular and so-called classical music become quite obscure. What's interesting about this band is it's the first band, that, at least that I know of, that I can think of anyway, where the people in the band sort of make themselves into art pieces. It's not like four people that you sort of know getting up. They come out and are purposely bad people, sort of like the late punk movement. They look very strange, the way they're dressed. They play very badly often. Often the sound reinforcement is so loud you can't stand it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're starting to make themselves into a kind of art piece, the same way that we had Alfred Jarret before, and later Vedekind and people of that sort, and ultimately Andy Warhol. What becomes ironic, and we won't talk about this much today, but we will later on, is that, like much of the revolutionary movement, the way it was ultimately ended by capitalistic society is by making the very ideals of the revolution into icons and then selling them. For example, by about 1975, you could go into a department store and buy faded blue jeans for about twice as much as you could buy normal blue jeans, so you didn't have to wear them for 3 years so they looked that way. Literally, I'm quite serious. Also about 1975, for the first time, long hair became quite chic, and you could get a long haircut for twice as much money as you could a normal haircut. And the same thing is true of rock and roll. By the mid-70s, essentially, rock and roll had become such a huge business, ironically enough, that capitalism, in essence, made a product out of it. And the first indication of sort of the end of rock and roll as a revolutionary movement is with the Woodstock Festival, which starts an enormously successful capitalistic presentation of rock and roll. Well, one of the more interesting bands to come out of this whole thing was in 1964, and by 1964, rock and roll had become a very political movement. You can, just to regress a second, you can see this because pretty much the folk movement that had been associated with the early 60s, like Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, was relatively over. In like 1964 is when Bob Dylan switches to electric guitar and has the band play with him for the first time, no longer appears with just acoustic guitar. This really surprised people. But at any rate, the band associated with Andy Warhol was a band called the Velvet Underground. And the Velvet Underground was formed among with four people. One was Lou Reed, one was John Cale. And John Cale was the person we talked about before, the one who was so influenced by Lamont Young and had worked a great deal in the Fluxus movement early on. There was also Maureen Tucker, who was their drummer, who didn't really play the drum. She just sort of stood there and went like this on a drum and a cymbal, usually, most of the time. And then there's Sterling Morrison. Well, this band was part of Warhol's circuit. They rehearsed at a place called The Factory. And later, in 1964, Warhol started doing happenings with them. And he called the happening the Exploding Plastic Inevitable. And the first one he did was at the Smithsonian Institute. And it was a retrospective of different kinds of happenings that were going on at the time. And so for Warhol's presentation, first of all, he made one of those mirror balls, you know, that you can shine a spotlight on and it circles around and the lights glitter. And then on stage he had the Velvet Underground playing. And the Velvet Underground, by the way, was also a very confronting band. There was absolutely no question that their lyrics were about sex, drugs, and rock and roll in some of the most overt ways any band had ever done it. And then while the Velvet Underground was playing, he had four transvestites on both sides of them dancing wildly. And this was what he called his happening. And this happening toured nationally, and it was always billed as the exploding plastic inevitable. Well, I thought I'd play a little bit of what they sounded like for you. The first album was, I don't have it here, the first album, Warhol did the cover for it. And it's a large yellow banana on white, and it says, peel here. And if you peel the large yellow banana, you get a nice orange banana underneath it. And that was the first record cover he did. The second record cover he did for the Rolling Stones. I don't know if you've seen it. It's just a zipper, like on pants. And it ruined most of the records because they warped, because the records couldn't bend at all because of the zipper. Anyway, on the second album, which is probably their most extreme album, this is one called Light, White Light, White Heat. The song I'm going to play for you is, again, one that commercially certainly could never have been played on the radio for a lot of reasons. One, it's very long. It's almost 20 minutes long. It's called Sister Ray. Second of all, you'll hear in this, like Fluxus being anti-art, this is very much like anti-music in a way. You can barely understand any of the words. It's extremely noisy, which is all part of the whole thing, because it was certainly possible in 1960, what is this, about 65, 66, to record very clean music if you wanted to. But that wasn't the point of the album. Also, some interesting aspects of it is that if you could hear the lyrics, which are almost impossible to hear, and you study them very carefully, you'd realize that actually they were composed by a kind of serial process. It's a very numerical process. There's only about 10 lines in the whole piece, and they keep recurring in specific kinds of orders. And again, like Fluxus, the whole idea of the piece is very, very minimal, almost no material at all, very little happening in the music, very, very long period of just this constant texture going on. Let me play a little bit of it. Texture. And I think that there's absolutely no question, I'll come back to this later again, that a lot of this texture is very much influenced by what Lamont Young was doing in about 1960, these very long, loud, basically static drones that would go on for a very long time. And as I say, John Cale was mostly playing viola and keyboard with Lamont in those days. Another just sort of a footnote, one of the people who sang with the Velvet Underground quite a lot was a woman by the name of Nico. Nico was a French fashion model originally, on the cover of Vogue magazine even. And in fact, she was in the, remember I mentioned once that Fellini asked John Cage if he'd be in his next movie, La Dolce Vita? Well, she is in that movie, in fact. She moved to New York early on, as I say, was associated also with the Warhol crowd. And she put out about six albums. And the reason I'm going to play just a little again is that I want to show you how unclear the categories are anymore. I think it's very difficult to know what to call this music. It was in the rock and roll bins, but exactly what it is, I think, is quite different. This album, which is her second album also, called The Marble Index, all of the music, every bit of it, was done by John Cale. He just overdubbed it. And most of the albums that Nico did were just John Cale or one or two other instrumentalists. This is the first song on it, there's a small introduction, and I'll play just a little bit of it. It's called Lawns of Dawn. It sold quite well. All of her albums did. This is a major label. It's Elektra Asylum, which is one of the biggest labels of the time. This music, like the music of people like Lamont Young and his band, remember the Eternal, what was it called? The Eternal Light Band? Was it? No, the Theater of Eternal Music. These groups were really very much appealing to the young radical people at the time, mostly the college-age people. And bands like Lamont mostly appeared either in art galleries or in colleges. And the same with people like Nico. They tended to be much more centered around the youth movement than anything else. One of the things, though, that's going to happen around 1964, as well as this sort of strange breaking down of categories, is a new kind of music coming out of the classical composers. And no matter what the political climate is, there's always going to be people that care primarily about sound and about music. And these people are going to start emerging out of this kind of confusion that started in the early 60s in 1964 with a piece actually called In C, which we'll get to in a second. Let me read you a quote of Lamont Young. This was from a recent interview. "I didn't go into music to earn money. I went into music because it was life's work and I'm driven, consumed by creative passion. It's true that I insist on earning money with my music, but I'm only interested in producing great works of art. Life is too short. That's why I stopped playing in dance bands. I could have earned a living in dance bands, sure. I could have also become a doctor or a lawyer or an Indian chief, anything. I went into music because I was drawn like iron filings to a magnet. The reason I am here on earth is to make music. I'm not here to make deals with Columbia Records." Well, one of the people that also played with Lamont early on was a man by the name of Terry Riley, who we've mentioned in a few other contexts. He was also one of the Fluxus artists that did a lot of conceptual pieces. Now, Terry Riley was a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley, in the same class as Lamont Young. They were born the same year, 1935. And Terry Riley grew up in California primarily, Colfax, in the country. And he still lives in the country in California and is, relatively speaking, a self-sufficient farmer. He grows all of his own food, et cetera, even though he still performs a great deal. Well, to show you the connection now, I think the connection starts to become very strong because NC is usually considered the very first really, truly, what we now call minimal piece. First, let me remind you of what Lamont said that I read you last time. "I strongly admit that I did not come out of a vacuum. I deeply appreciate people like Cage." Now here's what Riley said when he was asked what Lamont was like as a graduate student at the University of California. "Lamont was masterful, even in those days, much more masterful than any of my teachers. He knew what he wanted and very clearly demonstrated his musical ideas with no confusion, very clear and very strong. He was good in jazz improvisation and very spontaneous in his speech and his music. He's rare. I think Lamont is one of the people of our time to take note of. His achievement has been great, but not always in the spotlight, because he's working just for music's sake, never compromising commercially, which is rare. Most people have to. Lamont refuses to. Lamont could put you in a spaceship. I used to perform some of his music. You'd be looking at a score, wading through a duration of 25 seconds rest. I'd never done that before, you know. I mean, waiting for the next tone, which you're going to play for 45 seconds. It was like going somewhere in a spaceship. Time stopped, and I never had that experience. It's like an initiation. You're never quite the same afterwards. Well, the connection into what's going to be called minimal, and I'll play some of it in just a second, is this idea of very long expanses of sound, very, very slowly moving. Terry Riley is going to add certain features to it. He's going to bring back chords that were used in tonal music. In this piece especially, called In C, this is what it's based on. You haven't heard much of that lately in the last few classes. Terry Riley had many influences besides Lamont. One of the influences he had, again, was technological. And one of the things people were doing in those days, including Terry Riley, were making what we used to call tape loops. You'd take magnetic recording tape, and you'd cut it, and you would glue it together so you had this big loop. And then you could use it in all sorts of different ways. Some of them literally were like 30 and 40 feet long, and old electronic music studios used to have little poles everywhere so you could string up different sized tape loops. Well, one thing that Terry Riley was experimenting with that he liked very much was this notion that, let's say we have two tape recorders connected to a tape loop, okay? Now, let's say one records and the other one plays back. So when this one plays back, this one's going to record what this one just played. Now, if I add something to it each time, let's say I add one more note, I'm going to build up layer after layer after layer, because the first layer is going to keep getting recorded along with the second layer, along with the third layer, along with the fourth layer. So you'd build up this kind of texture. This was what he was doing with tape, and this is what he decided he wanted to do with sound. The other influences on Terry Riley, one was he was extremely and still is extremely interested in North Indian classical music, and he's a master of North Indian classical music. The other thing that is an extreme influence on Terry Riley, and as far as I can tell, almost everyone of his generation, was what was happening in jazz, especially in the 50s. People like Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk. Terry Riley was a very, very good jazz musician and earned his living most of his early life playing in clubs. Even when he went to Europe for 3 years, that's how he made his living in France, was playing in nightclubs. He played, among other things, like Lamont Young, soprano sax. He also played keyboard of various sorts. So we have this influence of jazz, North Indian music, Western music, Lamont's notion of very long, slowly evolving things. Well, in 1964, there was a place in San Francisco called the San Francisco Tape Center. It was started by, among other people, a man by the name of Morton Subotnick, who you'll be listening to in a few weeks. The place was kind of a, what would you call it, a post-happening multimedia. Those were the days of multimedia. In fact, Mort Subotnick started what was called the Electric Circus in New York, which was one of the first multimedia places. And multimedia where you would have light shows and sound and sometimes dance and sometimes theater, and all sorts of things would be going on at once. Well, Subotnick was a good friend of Riley, and they invited him to do a concert of his music at the San Francisco Tape Center. And so he decided to write a new piece for it. And the piece became a piece called In C, which was eventually to have enormous success and cross over lots of audiences. Well, In C is a very democratic piece. It's all it is 53 fragments of music that you get with the record, if you buy the record. Now, the whole time this piece goes on, someone plays a pulse. Someone is sitting at the piano going. So that's the first thing he's going to restore to music that is a little different than Lamont, is this idea of a pulsating rhythm. The other thing he's going to restore is the whole piece is going to be based around major chords. That's the whole piece. It takes about an hour to do that. It moves very slowly. And I think one reason it had such enormous success is I think people were really... It was like a drought. You know, music was in a very confused state in a lot of ways, and people were longing for the kind of sensuality of sound, the kind of sensuality that a chord like this could give you. They're also longing for the kind of hypnotic effect that a periodic rhythm would have over a long period of time. And this piece satisfied all of those, but still maintains the ideals of basically the post-Cage generation. Well, every player, and it can be for any kind of group of players, it takes at least about 8 different musicians to make the piece work. Each person plays each fragment, as I say, the 53, as many times as he wants, and then moves on to the next one, and plays that as many times as he wants, and then moves on to the next one, et cetera, et cetera. What is the play? As I say, any group can play it. Usually it's played by Western instruments, but there's a wonderful recording that came out about a year ago of a Chinese opera orchestra playing it on Chinese instruments, like Chinese gongs and different Chinese string instruments. There was also a performance in Mexico a couple years ago by a large group of Mexican marimba players, about 20 Mexican marimba players. So it can fit for anyone. Now, what does the player do? The player, as I say, plays each fragment. The player can coordinate with any pulse he chooses. He doesn't have to start with the first one. He can start with any one he wants. Once he starts, he can play it as loud as he wants or as soft as he wants the fragment. He can shape it so it gets louder or softer. He can phrase it in different ways, and he can interconnect it with other players. The very first fragment that the piece opens with is this one, which coordinates with like that, and then he moves on to the second fragment whenever. And Terry Riley gives a great different variety of materials that you go through. One of the things he gives quite a bit of in this piece are very long notes, like this one. He also gives, for the first time in music, in quite a while, in terms of this kind of music anyway, even little tunes. Let's see, where is the little tune? There we go. He also gives you things that sound just basically like textures. He also gives one that sound like pulse. Let's see, let's find a good one for that. I'll put it in octaves. Then he gives ones that are just sort of pulsating, like this. What happens is that you start getting all sorts of interrelations happening in the piece. But in a good Cagean way, the relationships that happen in the piece don't happen because of a pre-plan. It's not composed. It happens because of what the players choose to do as they continue through the piece. So the relationships that happen are coincidental, but they're there constantly. And again, the listener is free to sort of perceive the piece in any way he wants. Let me put on some now, and then I'll talk about it a little more in a second. This is from about one-third of the way into it. Process music or pattern music. Process because the form of the piece is defined by a process you go through. You play through your 53 fragments, and you go through the process. The piece is over when everyone is done going through 53 fragments. Sometimes it was called pattern music because it was made up of these 53 patterns. Later, minimal music was given as a term for this kind of music, largely from the art tradition. And the things that really define it later as what they called minimal music was this very, very long, slowly evolving kind of texture. And even though it uses tonality, as I say, chords, like in traditional music, this piece moves so slowly, it takes about 40 minutes to go through about the same number of chords as Bach would go through maybe in 2 seconds. So it's really, really, really drawn out. That's the Lamont Young influence in the whole thing. So we've got this new kind of music emerging. In 1968, Columbia Records records it, and it is a huge hit internationally. And it really changes how music starts being composed drastically at that stage. It crosses cultures. It gets reviewed in like Rolling Stone magazine as well as in classical journals. And without any exaggeration, even in places like Estonia, believe it or not, the last 3 generations of Estonian composers have all been extremely influenced by this kind of music and writing this style. Well, one of the people at the concert, well, let's go on just a little bit, see where we are. Concert is probably going to be the most responsible for making this style very popular is a guy by the name of Steve Reich. He's just a little younger. He was born in 1936 and again had a tremendous influence on the unfolding of music as it came about. Like Terry Riley, he was influenced a great deal by non-Western music. Unlike Terry Riley with North Indian, Steve Reich was very influenced by African drumming, and he actually went to Africa and studied drumming there in Ghana with Alfred Lakzepo. And he also became very interested in Javanese gamelan, which he also studied very seriously. Now, also, like Terry Riley, who was enormously influenced by jazz, especially at first Charlie Parker. He never heard any jazz or any Bach until he was 14 years old, and he heard both Charlie Parker and Bach about the same month, and both of them had a tremendous influence on what went after that. Another thing about Steve, which is similar to Terry Riley, is that he lived about half the time in California. He had a divorced family, and one member of the family is in California, one in New York, and he actually went to graduate school in California at Mills. That's where he was in his first performance of it. Also like Terry Riley, one of the things about Steve is that ultimately, more than anything else, he really cared about sound quality in music. We played a piece of his a few weeks ago called Come Out. Remember Come Out and Show Them, the tape loop piece? Well, when asked a question in a lecture a few years ago why he chose that particular phrase, he answered it this way. I thought I would play a little of Steve talking for you because it clarifies him a lot.
So my feeling about Come Out or any other piece is that anybody who does something to put across an idea, the first consideration is not that idea. The first consideration is the music. The reason I chose Come Out to Show Them, although it turns out to be a nice phrase, there are probably 100 other phrases that would have served idea-wise to get something across. It was that dee-da-da-da-da. It was the melodic content of the voice. C minor blues is something like that. That is why I chose it out of 10 hours of tape, because it was so overtly melodic. And in working out of the piece, it's a rather careful working out as opposed to its kind of range of process of unison to unison from unison to noise, the two extremes. Come Out is a more considered, polished piece. In any event, I believe that if you're going to do something that's political, this could be considered the Williams piece. The first obligation is to the music, because only in that way will the ideas come across. If the music is somehow not very great, then who cares? I personally don't give a damn what the guy is on, because I can read about and get some stations in the mail about the entire work of the piece. And, people who are devoting their lives to doing nothing but, Conrad Lynn is a name you never heard of, but he's a great civil rights boy. He's devoting his life to this. I mean, have second name composers telling me that I own a piece or that the other thing. So
he talks very fast. Well, Steve was extremely influenced by NC. He played in the first performance of it. So did Morton Subotnick, by the way. And again, one nice thing about this minimal tradition is it's recent enough so the lineage is very, very clear. It really goes very strongly from Cage to Lamont to Terry Riley to Steve Reich. Here's what Steve Reich says when he was asked about In C. Terry Riley was still composing it when I met him. I helped him put together the group that did it, which brings us to the history of this kind of music. It does not begin with Terry Riley. It doesn't begin with me, and it certainly doesn't begin with Phil Glass. It begins with Lamont Young, who was at the University of California in Berkeley with Terry in the late 50s. Lamont was dragging gongs on the floor, doing neo-cage things, and was otherwise getting interested in long tones. And we're talking real long tones. He wrote the Trio for Strings, a pivotal piece based mostly on perfect intervals sustained for long periods of time on three strings. This had a profound effect on Riley, who, as I understand, was still writing serial-type stuff, and who has tremendous music facility. He's a very, very fine musician. In C took these various strands, tape loops, African music, John Coltrane, and tied them all together. This undoubtedly was the trigger for my next piece. Now, with Steve Reich, you heard before the come out, which was that sort of gradual phasing between the two tape recorders. Now he wants to see if he can do it with real people. He figures that do you think you could really have two people play a piece that could do what those tape recorders did? Again, let me read you just a short quote from him. He's talking about phasing, which is that thing we were with come out. I felt I had discovered something which was addicting me. On the other hand, I felt, if I can't do this for instruments, it's a cheap trick. For 4 or 5 months, I just didn't know what to do. Somewhere late in 1966, I sat down at the piano, made a tape, and said, okay, enough of this. I'm the second tape recorder. I closed my eyes, which is significant, started playing with the tape in unison, the first pattern of a piece called Piano Phase, and found to my surprise, wow, I can do it. I'm not as perfect as a tape recorder, but I can do it. And what's more, doing it, performing it, is very interesting. This is the piece, I'll play just a little bit, called Piano Phase, which comes from 1966. And these are two live pianists now doing this gradual phasing. One person is playing absolutely steady and the other person is playing just the tiniest bit faster, the exact same music, so that it keeps sliding, just slightly forward the way it was doing. Consequently, Steve was forced, and probably for good reason, to form his own band. He called it Steve Reich and Ensemble, and musicians, I'm sorry, back in 1966. And he wrote exclusively for that group of musicians all the way up until about 1983. And by doing that, he was in complete control of the quality he could get. And that was very important to him because he was dealing with some very, very hard things. Now, even during that time, he was offered a commission by the New York Philharmonic, for example, and he turned it down. He turned down any opportunity to write for anyone other than his own ensemble. His own ensemble, by the way, still exists, and is still pretty much the same way. But the ensemble, like Nico and people like that, didn't ever really play in concert halls. Where they generally played were studio lofts, or art galleries, especially art galleries. And it was in an art gallery that that was sort of the center of minimal painting at that stage, where they took the word minimal and applied it to Steve Reich. Well, then you thought of another thing. Now we have this kind of gradual phasing. What instead of gradual phasing, let's try another kind of phasing. And he wrote a piece called Clapping Music the next year. And Clapping Music is based on an African drum pattern. Okay, and it sounds like this. Really does, because it is clapping music. It's for two people clapping. Now, this is almost exactly the pattern that's used in Ghana to hold the music together. They have a bell that they play. And it's always in 12 beats. You can see there's 12 beats here. And one of the nice things about 12 beats is that perceptually, you can hear it two different ways. One way you can hear it is three groups of four. But you can also hear it, depending on the way it's accented, as three groups of three. I mean, four groups of three. See how, depending on how I accent, you can hear it either way. What he does in this piece, which is called Clapping Music, is he has two people. And the first one does this the whole time, never changes. The other one starts with them, and then after a while, leaves out the last one so that he moves over one. You see, if I leave out the last one just one time, then I'm going to start here rather than here. And then he'll keep doing that until the whole thing cycles back. Again, that's why we call it processor pattern music, because the form of the piece is defined by a process, and the material of the piece is made up of these little patterns. Let me play a little clapping music for you. Cycles and comes back to right where they started, and they end in unison. And that's the end of the piece. The piece that really made a huge success, though, is a piece called Drumming. It was sort of this great work of, written about 1971. It made a huge success because for the first time in this whole movement, Deutsche Grammophon Gesellschaft, a European major record company, released Drumming. And this was sort of like an incredible confirmation of this music for the first time, because program notes now are in three languages, French, German, and English. It's a two-record set, and it's sold like wild world over. Again, crossing over all sorts of audiences, being reviewed again in Rolling Stone magazine as well as traditional journals. Well, in this piece, one of the things that he starts doing a lot are gradually building up patterns, where he'll play just one note of the pattern for a while, and then the first and second note, and the first, second, and third, until he builds up to this large pattern. For example, here's part four, just the beginning. I'll show you where it goes. And as I say, this piece had a tremendous influence on development of music, largely. For one reason, it was accessible. You could actually buy the record. Before that, it was very difficult to get a lot of this music. I'm going to end with just a brief example of another Harvard graduate by the name of Frederick Jeffsky, because I think it combines very much everything we've been talking about. It's a piece called Coming Together. Coming Together is, again, a kind of what was called minimalism in those days. And the whole piece is just based on this scale. It has a narrator in it as well. And the narrator, actually, and this is where it starts combining everything, is reading a very political text. Coming Together's base was dedicated, not dedicated, it was inspired by the prison riot in Attica in the early 70s, where a lot of the prisoners were killed. And most of the prisoners there were political prisoners because of the revolutionary movement. And one of the inmates there wrote a letter right before he was shot. He didn't know the riot was about to start. And this is the text. I think the combination of age and a greater coming together is responsible for the speed of the passing time. It's 6 months now, and I can tell you truthfully, few periods in my life have passed so quickly. I am in excellent physical and emotional health. There are doubtless subtle surprises ahead, but I feel secure and ready. And goes on from there, but basically that text. Well, what Frederick does in this piece is basically, he just gives the... Anyone can play it again. It's for any kind of combination, except you always have to have someone playing what he calls a bass. Of age and a greater coming together. And then all he does is he gives the performers rules of how to play the piece. And they can, he talks about the piece like they're all in prison. And this bass line is the constant, it's the prison. And then he gives you certain things you can do around this bass line, like limited freedom within the jail, to try to make it as good a situation for yourself as possible. For example, in the first section, they can play any of the notes that the piano is playing when the piano plays it and sustain it for a little while, making little melodies. Then the second section of the piece, he divides the group in half. And one half always plays the lowest note whenever the piano plays the lowest note. And then he puts in little accents. And whenever there's an accent, the other group plays that. So you get beep, be-doom, be-doom between the two groups. He calls that like bullets. So let me play a little of this. This is from 1972, Coming Together.
I think... The combination of age and a greater coming together is responsible for the speed of the passing time. I think the combination of age and a greater coming together is responsible the speed of the passing time. It's 6 months now, and I can tell you, truthfully, few periods in my life have passed so quickly. I think the combination of age.
Let me skip ahead a little bit. By the way, Frederick, among other things, was a Milton Babbitt student. And actually, the way the pitches, the order of the pitches, is all very serial kind of procedure. And there's 8 sections in the piece, and each section is interrelated either by inversion or retrograde inversion, using a lot of principles of serial music. So you get this sort of quirky combination in Frederick of jazz on one side, political on one side, minimal on one side, and serial on the last side. Let me just play one tad more.
Seldom employing histrionics, except as a test of the reactions of others.
So this takes us into the 70s, and you can see by the time we get to the 70s, the incredible number of influences that are on the table, if you like, for the American composer to choose from. And what we will do in the next few classes is talk about what this sort of grand buffet of possibility leads to and where it may go in the future. So have a wonderful Thanksgiving.